I learned, you know, how to just approach people. And so a camera really felt like a passport to just talking to strangers. And I really enjoyed news photography. And so I made that jump over.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, William Ravis, the official realtor of the Arts Foundation, the Kelly Foundation, and the Cape Cod Foundation. We couldn't do it without your support. We'd like to thank Bank 5, Cape Cod 5, Cape and Islands Workforce Board, the Cooperative Bank of Cape Cod. Hey there, this is Julie Wake, the Executive Director of the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod. Now in its fifth season, the Creative Exchange podcast is a celebration of the artists, arts leaders, and creative minds and their artistic journeys to bring joy, offer connection, and inspire hope through their work. Through the Creative Exchange, we discover what it means to be an artist in today's world and how the arts can bridge cultures and provide positive, meaningful change across all sectors and in our lives and our local, national, and global communities. Heather Piller is a photographer and teacher and has lived, taught, and photographed all over the world. Known for her series, Life and Death Matters, which documents the beloved Brandeis professor, Maury Schwartz. Heather digs deep into how life experiences are so connected to the things we find interesting or become passionate about. And then, what's the role of the artist during intimate moments, such as death? Please welcome the lovely Heather Piller.
Well, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And so, way back then. And I'm almost 60. So I started out I took a high school course, and Mr. Harbison, call out to him, from Gateway Senior High School in Monroeville. And then I just loved that course, but then moved on to college in Pittsburgh. I went to Carnegie Mellon. And then from that, I took a course that is public relations. And I thought, I'm a halfway decent writer. Mm-hmm. And so I then also at Carnegie Mellon, I was in a group called ISEC, which was this exchange group. And so I went to Finland on this exchange right after university. And I just fell in love with Europe and Finland and everything about it. And so when I moved back, I thought, I just want to be near older stuff. And also family was in Boston. And so I moved to Boston. And then I got a job in public relations. And then a little funny aside is that we hired a photographer from United Press International, and we were driving up to New Hampshire, and one of my clients was a log home company. And so it was, you know, taking pictures of log homes and styling them. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, so fun.
And then the photographer said, you know, I hire assistants. I pay $50 an hour. And I'm like, I'll do that. So, you know, back to photography. And so, I ended up just, you know, at lunchtime, I would go to the Boston Common. And that was one of my very first pictures is I photographed the Make Way for Ducklings.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a little kid jumping over them. So super cute. And so I come into the UPI offices, and I develop my film, and they're like, oh, nice, really nice. What's the kid's name? I'm like, I don't know. I was hiding behind a tree.
Right.
And they're like, you can't do that as a news photographer. Yeah, so that's what I learned, you know, how to just approach people. And so a camera really felt like a passport to just talking to strangers. And I really enjoyed news photography. And so I made that jump over from public relations to news and started working for you know, news organizations and stringing for the Boston Globe. And I worked for the Marlboro Enterprise and the Hart Hanks newspapers. And so I did a lot of that sort of thing and plus some freelance work. And then I landed at Brandeis University as the university photographer.
Oh, okay.
So that's how I have come full circle. So I've done like projects. I've always self-assigned my projects, like the welfare recipients and other things that I was telling you about women, infants, children. So that's where my interests have primarily lied in that area. And then what I at Brandeis, I was able to take a course a semester. And so I got my master's degree that way.
Ah, that's great.
Yeah.
That is really great. So before we get to the current work that you're working on, or something that's kind of current but has been over several years.
Longitudinal.
Yes. I want to talk a little bit about in your bio that you have lived, like for 20 years, you lived outside the country.
Yeah, so in 97, my husband and I got married, and we were teachers at Taipei American School and just loved the experience. And I had always wanted to be overseas again because of the Finland experience.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, my husband also loved it. And so he's still at it, in fact. Yeah. So he lives in Nigeria.
Yeah. Long distance.
It's a bit long distance, but yeah, COVID brought me back.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we're like, okay, now what? And so just to be here and our daughters are here and feeling like that is not good for us both to be so far away. So that's the reason.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Working out.
I mean, we all work it out. We all have, you know, our own things. You've had some really interesting projects, and one of the things I was looking at was in reading about where it's you're very like your photography is almost like a photo documentary to me. Would that be accurate to describe your work?
Yeah, I would call myself a documentary photojournalist.
Yeah, it's really they're really powerful, and so are your words in combination, and you learn so much, and I really thought the story. In your project on called Turning Points, a story about Mary, who was an addict. Was she an addict first and then turned her life around?
Yeah. So Mary and I met, it was one of my self-assigned projects.
Yeah.
Because when you're a news photographer for a daily paper, you're, you know, half your job. Well, let's say a third of the job is sports, solid sports.
Oh,
a third of the job is searching for features. Like, what are you going to put, like, on, like, you know, for people just to see what's in the community. And so I had looked at this place that was called Spectrum House and thought, oh, I wonder what that is. And so I just stopped in and then found out that it was for, it was a six-month recovery program. And this was, like, circa 1990.
Okay.
And I asked if I could photograph there, and they, you know, it was tricky.
Yeah.
But they let Mary show me around, and then I asked her. She was just so heartwarming. There was something about her that I was just so connected to and was really wanting her to – she just had such a positive outlook about life, and so I asked her – to give me a call, and she did after she left Spectrum House. And then I went to visit her and photographed her family for 7 years. Yeah.
For 7 years?
Yeah. It was kind of on off, but we were, like, I learned about, you know, her, and I left her in a good place, but, like, the one of the very first pictures are of was she was in a sort of a place that was in between houses. And so I do have a picture of her with two other friends. And the two other friends shortly after had overdosed again. And so it felt like, wow, like this, it's
real.
The cards are stacked against her. And
totally.
Yeah. but she wanted her children back. Mm-hmm. And she did that. And her family was very helpful. It was very mm-hmm. matriarchal, a lot of women. And so her mother, her grandmother, her sister, mm-hmm. And then her children. And she got a degree and she got a job. And she, in 97 when I left, and she also graduated. Mm-hmm. And so she was... So it was joyful. The whole story was like, wow, that's so fantastic. So that's where I left her in 97. And then I came back. We had kind of kept in touch a little bit, but mm-hmm. then I saw her in 2014, and she had cancer, mm-hmm. breast cancer. And she was also getting married, which was, so it was
bittersweet.
Bittersweet, yeah. Exactly the word that I keep thinking of for yeah. all of these projects that I do. It's like, mm-hmm. this is life, you know, and
is that bittersweet. What, yeah. Is that what hooks you? Like, what hooks, like, I love your work, and I love the whole, like, photo documentarian work, and to even, like, doing it myself with my kids and my, you know, and it's just... And I also am so interested in other people's lives. Like, I would consider myself a little bit of a voyeur. Like, I'm so interesting. It's so interesting to
pick up the camera and then yeah. do it.
To really, like, get a glimpse.
Yeah.
You know, and not like the rich and famous, but the real people.
Uh-huh, yeah.
The story. So what compels you to these, especially because these stories, some of these stories that we can talk about were driven by motivated and inspired you alone, like you weren't hired to do them.
Well, I did have. Luckily, I was.
Like you could pick
a news photographer.
Yeah,
and so and I had a camera.
Right.
So it was like,
yeah.
I needed to. So I had the kind of like a job that allowed me to do that, and I definitely. I don't know that you can actually. Do that anymore because of what news has become and what, I mean, maybe because I've been away from it for so long, but, you know, I do know that local papers, you know, just don't have those kinds of resources anymore. And it's too bad because I do feel like it really should be something that is of interest to everybody. You know,
absolutely.
It's your community.
We used to have a little local paper here. I think it was I don't want to say the name, but it was like a little local paper. And I loved it because it would cover people. I knew everybody that they wrote because it's such a small community. And some of the photos, but the write-ups were very like, oh, wow, so-and-so got a new job or so-and-so got in trouble or, you know, or this, you know, organization is merging with this. You know, it was always so interesting to get the local news. And I do really miss that, the actual like dropping it off mm-hmm. at my driveway. But so the journalism piece, the photo journalism piece hooked you. But, you know, you didn't have to pick Mary's story. Like, what compelled you to interview her? Like, why? You were just interested in Spectrum, the...
Well, she was assigned to me. So I think it was kind of, I don't know, what you call it, luck or fate
yeah.
or something like that.
Yeah.
And then I connected with her.
Yeah, yeah.
And she, I have always felt like she wanted to be seen, to be, to have her story told. I think she deep down knew that, you know, because she did everything, quote unquote, right. You mm-hmm. know, like she had, you know, she had her husband, she had a job, and it was, and then, and children, and it was too much. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just overwhelming, and turning to drugs was a relaxation that turned into something, you know, really... Not good, and of course it destroyed the marriage, and you know, just and she's not the only one by far.
It's too common of a story. Right. So I think it's a really just seeing the photos, and we'll share that link to your website so people can see what we're talking about. So tell me a little bit about, you had two other projects that I thought were very interesting. The wisdom of, well, no, we don't want to talk about that one yet. I want to talk about Maury after.
Save it to the end.
Yeah. Just, I want to just touch on the, like, I love your work with families, girls. Tell me a little bit about the Bangladesh, the Asha Hopes, and then for Bangladeshi girls in their future. Tell us about that.
Principal, Julie Alden, it was her idea. So the school is the American International School of DACA, AISD, and we worked there from 2005 to 2009. In about 2000-ish, there was a woman who had started a school for street children. And so basically she literally took children off the street and I think fed them first and then like showered and clothed them and then wanted to start a school. And the American International School of DACA is like helping participatory and giving equipment and things like that. And so there's a board now and it's doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. And so there are, I don't know, but then there were about 50 children, not just girls, but from about kindergarten to fifth grade.
Okay.
And this is, the parents had to sort of agree to certain conditions and then their children could go to this school. It was a big deal because it was not the, you know, the public school, which was like jam-packed with like 50 students. This is like, you know, smaller classrooms.
Like private school for them.
Right. Yeah. And also looking after like healthcare and things like that. So so Julia had asked me to photograph and asked Nora Graham, another teacher and a friend, to design it. To design a book. And the idea was to make a book. And Julia interviewed the girls and I photographed. So I went to their homes and to their parents. You know, what did they do? Well, they basically did like rickshaw wala. So somebody who, and those rickshaws are heavy.
Oh, yeah.
So
dangerous.
And you can't really get ahead. It's like the idea of, you know, being a rickshaw wala is like you ride and it's exhausting and then you rest up and then you have to rent your rickshaw again. And then, so it's just subsistence really. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, maybe there was a little kiosk in selling fish or selling some things. Mm-hmm. So that's what the parents did in general. And usually there was a community place to like for bathroom and kitchen and one room, like the whole family in the one room. Right. So those are what my photographs show. Mm-hmm. And also one of the most sad pictures is about the healthcare. And so a girl, Mabia, she fell out of a tree when she was 9 years old and there was no healthcare. So basically her arm was amputated. Yeah, it's just something that could be fixed.
Right.
Yeah. And so, just kind of understanding like poverty and like, and this is not, I mean, there were people on the streets and just the poverty is definitely like really in your face where maybe poverty here is a bit more hidden
for sure. Mm-hmm. How did you protect yourself from the emotional, like, kind of trauma of hearing these stories?
I think photographing. Also, so the book was made to sell to raise funds for a better school that would not get flooded because it was in a floodplain. And actually, that happened. They are in a better place.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's so interesting, and I love the idea of that work and and being able to tell those stories is so, like, how else would we know?
Yeah, I think it's a real eye-opener.
Yeah. Let's jump into the wisdom of Maury. So tell us, how did you, I mean, this is an incredible story that you've told through your photography. How did you get connected? Tell us from the beginning. Like, how did you meet Maury?
But first, let me just say that The Wisdom of Maury is the book that's coming out.
Yeah.
And that is Rob Schwartz editing Maury's words. So it is coming out April 18th.
Okay.
And Rob Schwartz is a journalist for many, many years. He lived in Tokyo, and now he's back here in Boston. And so anyway, hopefully people will want to pick that up. And I have a beautiful picture of Maury and Rob together, and it's won some awards and things. And so that is in the book. Maury is of, most people would know of, Tuesdays with Maury. So Tuesdays with Maury is with Mitch Albom, and he was Maury's student, and Maury was his mentor, and so they had a very close relationship, and so they met every Tuesday, very now famously. And so it's lovely to have heard that story. And this is, my story is really with, it started out with me being at Brandeis and taking some courses. And so Maury Stein was my professor. And it was, you know, January 1995, and Maury Stein told us, the class of like eight people, that his friend had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and that he was learning how to live and die. And he brought it up every class, and we meditated, and I thought, wow, I wonder what I should, you know, do with this. It seems to me like, you know, I should do something. So I said to Maury Stein, do you think he would be amenable to photographing? And in my documentary way, and Maury Stein thought yes. But then I called Maury Schwartz, who didn't know me really. Right. And he's like, oh, I've had enough attention, like, you know, basically no thank you. And I went back to my professor, Stein, who's like, let's just discuss this. And so we discussed it, the three of us, and Maury Schwartz, and wanted parameters around it, which was fair enough. And so they were that that we would make an exhibition together with my photographs and his aphorisms, and to be shown really before he died was the was the plan, and if possible. And that he could call it off at any time, and that would be okay. And of course, it had to be. And that his wife did not want to participate, but she he wanted to make it clear that she's involved very much in his care in every other way. So I am sad that I don't have a picture of Maury and Charlotte, but anyway.
Interesting. Yeah. But yeah, that makes sense, that those parameters and...
Yeah. And he was wonderful. He would then, you know, let me know that this person's coming or that person is coming, and I would want a picture. And he absolutely loved the first picture I photographed of him, which was him at his living memorial with his hands in front of him.
Yes. Yeah.
And he's smiling, and you can tell he's in a wheelchair. And he always had it displayed, and he was just lovely. He just made, you know, so many people coming through his home, and I was just kind of aware that, like I didn't want to take away from others, you know. So I was really, I tried to be a bit of a fly on the wall.
How'd you do that?
I can just kind of make myself small and unobtrusive, and flash. I mean, because that's too obtrusive.
This topic is just so heavy, right? Documenting someone's slow or maybe quick demise from ALS. It's a pretty horrible thing. What were the, like, some of the challenges with telling this story? Did you know, were there photos that you were like, oh, this is just too much, or, you know, did you have to censor yourself a little?
I always felt that it was not too much.
Oh, good.
But yeah. I think other people did.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, like the, so I did have an exhibition at Brandeis with my photographs and Maury's aphorisms. Mm-hmm. It was not complete because he died in November. Mm-hmm. And I photographed till late October. Mm-hmm. And then I have since photographed a little bit at his grave. Mm-hmm. And so it's more complete now. And also the pictures were chosen were more happy pictures versus, but I, you know, there's the bittersweet.
Yeah.
You know? And so going back to those negatives and really combing through them, I've chosen pictures that are some struggle. I mean, not all. And then some so joyful, like mm-hmm. the one that's at Cape Cod Museum of Art
right
now
is
the theme was Happy Place. Mm-hmm. And so the picture is with Maury and his very good friend, Professor Charles Derber. Mm-hmm. And they are just having this lovely moment. And it is just something that's very, it's a very happy place.
Mm. How long is it going to be at the Cape Museum of Art?
April 2nd is when the show comes down.
Okay, and through April 2nd. Okay, we'll make sure that. We promote that. When I first learned about your project and we met at one of the Creative Exchange mm-hmm. meetups, ever since we met, I was thinking about that, you know, what is the role of artist, photographer in that space where someone's dying or is, you know, not feeling well? And, you know, we don't see those photos. We don't see, you know, so what were some of the challenges and maybe some of the things that you really took away from, like, those moments?
Right. So it's kind of like, what did I learn from Maury?
What did you learn from him?
Yeah. Well, it was between that and also thinking about death, which I think I have done throughout my life because I had asthma as a baby.
And interesting. Okay.
So, I mean, I was in and out of hospitals as well. I mean, Pittsburgh was just billowing smoke at the time I was growing up. And it's cleaned up its act. It's a much nicer place to live. And so, like, thinking about death, like, because I do remember, like, sitting up in bed and not being able to breathe and mm-hmm. trying to fall asleep and things like that. So there was that. There was my grandmother who had Alzheimer's, and she was in a nursing home for about 13 years, which is tragic.
Very.
Yeah. So she had died, I think it was 92. So, like, by 95, you know, and here I am, like, thinking more about life than death, but it's not like I hadn't thought about it. And, and then Maury dying in a way that is not, like, hidden, and he wanted people to come, and it was just really a breath of fresh air, mm-hmm. like, speaking about breathing.
Right.
And it was, like, I found it so interesting and definitely something to learn about. And you know, and I think it's there's memento mori. Have you heard that phrase?
No.
It means remember you must die, which sounds a bit morbid, but the idea is like,
accept it.
Right. Yeah. And the more you come to terms with that, the more you actually live. It's that bittersweet dichotomy thing. And so the whole idea of, you know, if you have come to terms with that you will die, what will you do with your life? What will you do with this precious time you have on this planet?
You know, I've been reading about, you know, people put calendars up, you know, they kind of say, okay, my average lifespan will, you know, my goal is to live to 85 or 95 or whatever. And then they put up calendars and they get the dates, how many, you know, weeks they have left. And that is supposedly being, like acts as an inspiration to, you know, to kind of, you're going to face death one of these days. I find that to be very anxiety inducing.
Yeah.
So I don't recommend it. But I've heard it's like a very popular thing right now. Yes. And it's it's horrifying to me.
Yeah.
And even talking about it, I'm like, I don't want to know exactly how many days. But, you know, what does motivate us, you know?
Yeah.
And it sounds like Maury had kind of accepted it. And your work is just beautiful, the way you've captured him laughing and embracing people. What kind of pushback did you get from this type of project? Because this isn't just a, you know, this is heavy.
Well, pushback.
Or did you get anybody that said, I think that's inappropriate?
No, and I just looked through the comments, and people actually were grateful.
Yeah.
And I think it was the publishing, because I did approach, I showed Mitch's publisher, actually, who was like, oh, love it, chapter openers, but then fell apart. We'll just use the one picture of Mitch and Maury in the back. Mm. And then I moved to Taiwan and, you know, it's kind of like, it was a surprise to find, you know, the idea was just 20,000 copies for the first press run. And then it was like, I'm in Taiwan and reading 4 million copies, really? And so it was a surprise to, I think, I know Mitch was also quite surprised.
That's amazing.
But yeah, so the whole phenomenon, and I think people are really wanting to, or needing, actually, I would say maybe not wanting, but maybe needing to talk about it. And then being around the world and looking death, you know, like being like in Nepal and I remember seeing a 2-year-old baby, you know, wrapped up and ready for the, a ceremony. You know, it was just, the baby was dead, but, and, you know, being on the Ghats in India and, you know, like people around the world face death in a lot.
You know? Yeah,
like,
in a more open.
Right in front, yeah. It's front and center. And
because it happens at the mortality rates.
Yeah, even our food is sanitized. Like you don't see like, oh, this actually was a chicken, you know, but then you have a chicken like, the head has come off right in front of you, and then it's like, okay, you know where your food is coming from, and
right.
So,
what types of things could you relay about the role of an artist, kind of capturing something that isn't like perfect? You know, like death isn't perfect, so it's okay. I'm going to ask you in a different way. What made you think, as an artist, that you could capture that? Like, what made you think you could do that and that people would be, like, okay with it? It's just so interesting. I really want to, like, it. Like the topic of death is so, I don't know, like, you don't want to talk about death, but you did. So what motivated that?
I mean, I wasn't planning on it. I think it just was, like,
was the opportunity presented.
Yeah. And I think it's just having to be curious about, you know, okay, I thought, okay, the funny thing is with students, because I've been a teacher for so many years, but, we had a unit and I taught fifth grade for a little while and the unit was called Circle of Life. And so it was bringing in like pictures from, you know, your life and then just kind of projecting out and what do you think? And students would like, they're okay, you get married, you have kids, you're done. It's like, you know, like life pretty much ends.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
For a fifth grader, I would say around 25. Yeah. You know? I was like, well, there's more to it. And so I think that's the reason, like, just, you do want to have some understanding, and especially when you don't have like extended families living together. And, you know, we like to hang out with people who are basically our same age and, you know, but, and it's so much fun to be around a baby, you know, and a child. But older people and becoming one, going into this, I would say, like, it's nice to hang out with older people too, right?
Hosted by Arts Foundation's Executive Director, Julie Wake, the series is an ode to the artistic process and its unique manifestation on Cape Cod and beyond. Thanks for listening.